Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast for the Olympians is brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And we are rapidly approaching Mr. Olympia time. Next weekend will be the Mr. Olympia, the biggest weekend in bodybuilding. And to celebrate that, we are going to play an interview that I did with Sean Ray. I actually did this interview a few years ago in 2015, but we had a really good two-part interview. So today will be part one. And we talked about Sean Ray's career in bodybuilding. And he had an incredible career in bodybuilding. And actually, today is Sean's birthday. It's September 9th. So to celebrate Sean's birthday and to celebrate the Mr. Olympia, we are going to replay this interview we did with Sean Ray. So in part one of our interview with Sean today, he's going to talk about how he got into bodybuilding and training with John Brown when he was still a teenager. And then Sean won the Teenage Nationals. And he went on to win the Junior World Competition in Australia. And then he went on and he won the Nationals at only 22 years old with one of the most incredible physiques ever to win the Nationals. And then Sean talks about the beginning of his pro career, including a couple of bumps he had on the road, getting suspended in 1989 because he had a neck injury and he was not able to compete in the Arnold Classic. And then they suspended him for a whole year, so he was not able to compete in the Olympia that year. And then in the Arnold Classic, the next year in 1990, he, of course, failed the drug test, which we all know about. And then he finally came back and really got it together in 1990 at the Mr. Olympia, where he took third place. So we talked with Sean all the way up until 1992, which was Dorian's first Mr. Olympia win. So we're going to have a really, really good interview coming up soon with Sean Ray in a couple minutes. And I do want to mention that we are brought to you by Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is a supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. And you may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn. This is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner. Or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe contest in 2012. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 Classic Physique Olympia champion and the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. And Breon will be defending his Olympia title next weekend out in Vegas. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will receive a 12% discount off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com, or you can go to amazon.com and make your purchase there. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right. So yeah, we got one more week for the Olympia. And as I said, I am very excited to be going out there. This is my first time going to the Olympia since 2011. So it'll be 7 years since I've been to the Mr. Olympia. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. I'm looking forward to being at the expo. And I, like I said, I will be at the Old School Labs booth, and I will have copies of all my books, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends, Volume 1, Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder, and the MP6 Workout. I will have all those copies available if anybody wants to stop by and purchase a copy. But if you don't, just stop by anyways and say hi to me. I'll be at the Old School Labs booth Friday and Saturday, and I hope I can get a chance to see the competition both nights also. I really want to check out the Classic Physique Olympia, where Breon will be defending his title, but he's going to have some really, really good competition. I want to see what that Wesley Vissers looks like. That's the guy that looks a lot like Arnold. He has a physique very similar to Arnold. And then, of course, Chris Bumstead, who was a very close second to Breon Ansley last year. So it should be really a great, great competition in that Classic Physique. And I want to see what kind of posing these guys do, because I'm hoping that the Classic Physique category brings back that classic type of posing that we all used to love back in the golden era. And then 212 division, I believe Flex Lewis will be competing in his last Olympia at least in the 212 division. I think he's going to make a comeback in another couple years in the open division. But in the 212 division, this will be Flex's last title defense. And I want to see what my friend Jose Raymond looks like, because this will also be Jose's last Olympia. And Derek Lunsford, who trains at our gym. He's been training at Powerhouse Gym and Powerhouse Gym Athletic Club in Tampa, where I train. And I see Derek all the time. I've never really met him because he's very serious in contest mode. But he is looking really amazing, and he's a young guy. So he's got a great future in the sport. I think he's going to be way up there this year also. So that's going to be a great competition. And then, of course, we have the Mr. Olympia contest, and Phil Heath will be going for title win number 8. He will tie Ronnie Coleman and Lee Haney if he wins this year, and I think he probably will win, because I just don't see anybody who's going to beat him with that kind of conditioning and that 3D type of look that Phil has, and he always manages to hit his peak. You know, Phil is really never off. He was off a couple of years when he was up with Kai, but being a 2-day show, they do the prejudging on Friday and the finals on Saturday. Phil usually gets it together for that second night on Saturday. But the last few years, Phil has been on target both nights. So he's won pretty decisively the last couple of years, and I think he'll win again easily this year. But you never know. So I will be watching at the show, and hopefully there will be some surprises. I think Big Ramy can do something. I'd love to see Cedric McMillan, who is my favorite pro bodybuilder. I'd love to see him come in really top condition like he did at the Arnold and really shock Phil. That would be great. I think the dark horse of this year is going to be Brandon Curry, because I've been looking at pictures of him on Facebook, and he's been out in Kuwait for the last year. And I always thought Brandon had a great physique, great genetics, great shape. He just was never big enough or ripped enough, and I think he is just extraordinarily big. He's super big now. And if he comes in condition, I think he's going to be the dark horse. He might be in the top 5. So be on the lookout for Brandon Curry. But it's going to be a great show, and I will report on it next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I'll give you guys all my report and all the things I saw at the expo and what went on, and I will give that to you next week at the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So I hope you'll tune into that. All right, and over the last week, we got a lot of emails about the Lee Labrada video, part 2. We put up Lee's interview in 3 parts. So we have part 2 up last week, and it was on YouTube, and it's also on the bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. If you want to check that out, we have all our video interviews and all our podcasts on bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, as well as many articles that I've written. So if you've never been on the website, please go on and check it out. All right, so I wanted to read some of these comments that I got. We got a lot of comments on YouTube, as we always do whenever I put up a new video interview, because we've got a lot of loyal fans who love watching these. So we got an email from Guy Graham on YouTube, and Guy said, Lee was great. Not many middleweights went on to do well in the pros. Arguably could have beaten Haney if the sport was judged on all the criteria it is said to be. And then Southern Cross made a comment, said Lee Labrada should have been the 1989 and 1990 Mr. Olympia. RT said today's bodybuilders just stomp around on stage and stick their tongues out. Labrada was all class. And Guy Graham again said, wow, watching Lee's shoulders drop at the announcement of the 90 Olympia says it all, and to be leading after the prejudging. And then Guy says, the usual question, John, is who's next? Ha ha. I don't know, Guy. We're still working on that. Ivan Candido said, Labrada, amazing bodybuilder. In my opinion, one of the best ever. Cyberpump said, the judging in the open is warped today, and for a change to take place, it starts there. There was no reason to make a classic division. Zigro Mulis says, anyone know who the place presenter to Sean Ray is at the minute 56:38 seconds? He looks like a fellow gym member I trained with in Mentor, Ohio, back in the 80s, Rick Ciotti. Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to watch that tape again, but I remember Rick Ciotti, so possibly could have been him. He could have been a presenter at that show. Bill Nealon, one of my friends from down south in Florida, said, John, I just listened to Lee Labrada interview. He's another one of my heroes, just an outstanding individual. A great comprehensive interview once again, and you really did Lee justice. Well done. All right. Thank you, Bill. I got a comment from Dazzle Star, and he said, Lee looks phenomenal for his age. And he says, John, I think you're the best bodybuilding interviewer I've ever listened to, along with Peter McGuff. Very neutral, and the tempo is superb. Wow, thank you very much. Being Peter McGuff's company, that's an excellent compliment. And then he also says, the posing on the Lee Labrada interview is sheer masterclass. In fact, the best ever. And I wrote to Mike Ashley after one of our viewers suggested that we talk to Paul Jean Guillaume. I sent an email to Mike Ashley asking if he knew Paul's contact information, if you still stayed in touch with him. And I also asked Mike if he was going to be at the Olympia, because I think Mike was out there last year. And Mike wrote me back and he said, hi, John, thanks for reaching out to me. Unfortunately, I will not be able to attend the Olympia this year as I'm back in school and currently very busy with being a student along with business demands. Someday I hope to create a business which allows me the flexibility to travel more than I do now. I do not have a contact information for Paul, but if you do get in touch with him, please pass on my information. He's a really great guy, and I hate the fact that we lost contact. Enjoy the Mr. Olympia and all the best. So unfortunately, Mike did not have any contact information for Paul Jean Guillaume. I was hoping he would. I thought he said he still stayed in touch with him, but I guess not. One of my old friends from Chicago, Terry Strand, emailed me. He included a link to an interview that Peter McGuff did with Tom Platz many, many years ago. Not many, many years ago. I think it was when Peter was still working for Joe Weider. And he said, here's a great long-written interview with Platz by Peter McGuff from the Golden Age of Bodybuilding Facebook webpage. But just compare it with what it would have been if it would have been a video interview. Then you would get all the emotion of Tom without having to type out the whole thing. Great YouTube and blogging video interviews, especially those of the champ and superfan John Hansen, were the major change which took us from dry interviews from afar to up close and personal interviews. Yeah, I am still working on Tom Platz and Samir. I've been trying to get both of these guys to give me some video interviews, and I think I will see both of them at the Olympia. I know Samir will be there. I hope Tom will be there. So I am going to keep bugging him and try to get those guys, especially Tom. I think it would be a great interview. But Samir also, we have to do part two of our interview with Samir, because we did part one many years ago. I think it was like 3 years ago. So we are long overdue for part two. So I will keep working on that, guys. Marion Califoro says, I love listening to your interviews during my workout. I am 30 and I follow what 80s bodybuilding advice is as training wise. John Doe said on YouTube, now that's posing. Yes, aesthetically beautiful compared to today, no comparison. And he was talking, of course, about the Lee Labrada interview. Luis Gomez says, they don't make bodies like this anymore. The 80s were the best in bodybuilding. Lee Labrada has a beautiful body. Michael R. said, man, Labrada looked great at 1990 Olympia. He is one of the few guys that you can genuinely say he looked good without adding a qualifying statement such as, well, he looked good considering that it was a tested show. Most guys didn't look like themselves. Only a few, such as Labrada and Mike Christian, to name a few, look good and like themselves, but maybe a little flatter with smaller legs and backs. I can't even begin to imagine how much competing in the 1990 Olympia must have sucked. Being contractually forced to appear on stage and absolutely know that you weren't going to look your best. Then add in that there are going to be hundreds of photos of you taken when you aren't looking your best. That would totally suck. Your work your whole life to be your best, and suddenly you're told you have to compete in a compromised state. JWB said on YouTube, I've been saying for years, Lee Labrada's 1989 routine is the best posing of all time. And our friend Scott Barron, who is a donor to the show. And again, guys, if you want to be a donor to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast to keep it going, you can just go on our website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and there's a Patreon link in the upper right-hand corner. Just click on that. If you want to spend as little as $5 a month, I would appreciate it. But Scott is one of our donors, so I wanted to mention that. And Scott is from Chicago, and he wrote, John, I thoroughly enjoyed your Lee Labrada Part 2 episode. I was brainstorming possible topic ideas, and I came up with two interesting ones that are meaningful but would require flexibility with your tried and true format. The transition that bodybuilding took from the ending of most print magazines to the internet would be interesting and historically significant to explore. What happened to the legendary bodybuilders who, in the midst of their bodybuilding competitive careers, experienced this transition firsthand? Perhaps they experienced the beginning of their careers in print magazines, but ended their careers with coverage online. No doubt this topic can become somewhat complicated because coverage online began before YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram became so incredibly popular. Case in point, remember MySpace. I'm certain there were certain growing pains for some bodybuilders during this transitional time. Key question is, what were they? The second topic idea deals directly with the legendary late Joe Weider. How has bodybuilding and the Mr. Olympia changed over the years since the passing of Joe Weider? That's a good question. Answering this question would require interviews with the bodybuilders who knew him best and with analysis from Peter McGuff. As always, your historical contribution to the art and sport of bodybuilding is greatly appreciated and thoroughly enjoyed. All right. Thank you, Scott. Got some good comments there. Yeah, I've always wondered about that, too. About we've talked many times specifically with Peter McGuff and with Wayne Galash, and I think a little bit with Roger Schwab, about how bodybuilding has changed so much, especially since the magazine stopped and now everything is on the internet. And I know also Chris Aceto has mentioned that before when he was talking to Dave Palumbo. So it really is a different sport, and that's why we are still celebrating the golden era of bodybuilding here on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, guys, here is our interview with Sean Ray. This is from 2015, so it's a couple of years old, but it's a great interview where Sean talks about his whole bodybuilding career, and we're going to go all the way up until the 1992 Mr. Olympia contest. And happy birthday, Sean. Today, Sean is 53 years old today on September 9th. Here you go. All right, welcome to the Bodybuilding Legends Show, and my very special guest today is Sean Ray calling in from California. How you doing, Sean?
Good.
So, yeah. Sean, I want to talk to you about your great career in bodybuilding. I think you're one of the I think personally you're one of the best physiques ever in the sport of bodybuilding, and sometimes maybe not as appreciated as some of the other physiques. So I just want to talk to you about how you got into bodybuilding. You started competing after playing football, correct, in high school?
Yeah, as a sophomore, they asked me to play varsity, and coming up to play varsity, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I messed with my computer, just lost your picture. Playing varsity football with the big boys, I had to get on a weight training program.
Okay.
And in doing so, I was a smaller guy. I played running back, and all the juniors and seniors were working out and had a designated area for them to train. We had a guy come over and do a weight training demonstration. He just happened to be Mr. Western America at the time, and his son was in my grade. Hmm. And when he showed us how to properly squat and deadlift and do these lifts, I was blown away at the poundage he was using with relative ease. And yet, you know, he had the delts, the triceps, the bicep, all the stuff that I never really looked at, you know. And by the time I got done with this little demonstrative training session that Bill Gray, that's his name, and his son's name is Bill Gray, my friend, he invited everyone to the gym. He said, anybody wants to come train for a week? You know, I'm giving all you students an opportunity to come and train for a week, all the Eldorado Hawks. Mm-hmm. And I went down there. I was like, I took to it like fish to a water. I dove in. Something snapped in me that made me think and believe I had to be strong and I had to be powerful if I was going to play varsity football as a running back.
Okay.
They wanted me to play varsity football as a defensive halfback. And I knew that, you know, junior All-American football, I played both. But at the high school level, most of those juniors and seniors were much taller.
Right.
And I knew as a defender, I was going to be at a disadvantage. But as a running back, I could run with and by the bigger and faster guys all day long. And I knew I needed to get bigger and faster and stronger, so to speak. And I joined that gym, and Mr. Gray kind of, took me under his wing a little bit and showed me a few lifts. And then I joined another gym, and that's when I met two-time Mr. Universe, three-time Mr. World, John Brown. And that's where my whole mentality about trying to be the best came from. I mean, I wanted to be a bodybuilder. As a junior, I wanted to be a bodybuilder, but I started lifting weights as a sophomore.
So what did your physique look like, Sean, when you met John Brown? Because obviously he must have saw something in you to take you under his wing and try and teach you the ropes.
Well, I don't know. I was a football player. Okay. So he saw something. He saw some genetics, and I didn't even know what genetics meant. He saw potential, but I think more importantly, he saw the work ethic.
Yeah.
When I do something, John, I'm in it to win it no matter what. I mean, when I played football, I was playing for the Heisman Trophy as a high school player, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to be the premier I wanted to be the premier football player when I played, and I thought the weight training would complement that. And my body just, in 5 months' time, John Brown had me on a bodybuilding stage as a teenager, and I got second. I lost out to a heavyweight guy. And a week later, I beat the same guy that beat me. And that right there solidified that, you know, it was like an instantaneous gratification and validation of the 4 weeks of dieting, which seemed like an eternity as a teenager.
Right.
But I could beat a bigger guy. I could beat a guy bigger than me, you know. So that rubber match happened the following year, and I beat the guy 2 out of 3 shows. And he happened to wind up owning the gym that I would ultimately be training at when I won the 1987 Nationals and the 1987 Mr. California.
Oh, wow.
From there, you know, my career took off, obviously, winning the Team Nationals, Junior World Championships. But John Brown, I got a taste of professional big-time bodybuilding when John came home from Germany one day. And he was on tour, and he threw a bunch of money down on his bed, and it looked like it was $1 million. It might have been $1,000. I was a junior in high school, but it could have been $1,000, but it looked like $1 million. And I thought, where'd you get that from? And he said he was over there doing exhibitions and posing in Germany. And I thought, well, you're doing it in Germany. Do they do it over in England? Do they do it over in Australia? Do they do it? I got the global concept of the sport, and I thought, if I can be good, well, maybe I won't have to get a job. I can do what he's doing. He was living the life. He was driving a Mercedes-Benz. He had cash money in his pocket, a slew of trophies to show for his efforts, and some magazine covers. And I thought, in high school, with no bodybuilding friends in high school, that this was the lifestyle I wanted for me.
Right. Now, you sort of talked a little bit about your teenage career, but I remember hearing somebody talk about you when you were a teenager, and they said when you used to step on stage and everybody came out, the crowd would start laughing because they thought it was a joke because they thought you were in the men's open and you were competing in the teenage because you were so far ahead of everybody.
And it's interesting because it never sunk in. I mean, I won as a teenager. I won relatively easy all the way up through the juniors. You know, my first blip, my first roadblock was the 84 Teenage Nationals. I lost to Franco Santarello, and Franco was a repeat national champion. He won like when he was 17.
Yeah.
He won the national teenage nationals at 17 and 18 years old, I believe. He was a freak.
Yeah.
But I'd been lifting weights for a year, and I still managed to get second place. But winning when I started came pretty easy. And I said when I won the nationals, when I realized, you know, the elite status of a professional bodybuilder, I said then that I'd lose more contests than I win as a professional.
Yeah.
But that it didn't matter because I was just trying to be Mr. Olympia. That's why I was competing. That's why I was lifting the weights. And I think that served me well coming up. I knew coming out of the teenage ranks that I wanted to be Mr. Olympia. I didn't want to be Mr. Iron Man, and the Arnold Classic hadn't even been developed at that stage, and I didn't care about German, Italian, all the other Grand Prix type stuff that was going on around my economy. I wanted to be Mr. Olympia, and I pretty much devoted my career and my time to trying to do that. Knowing that, you know, Chris Dickerson in 82 had won it, and he was smaller than I was. I'm 200 pounds and 5'5". 1983, my junior year in high school, Samir Banu won it. He was 5'6", maybe 200 pounds at best. And then, of course, Lee Haney came along to change the game at 5'10 and roughly 240. I came along maybe 5 years too late in terms of having a real opportunity to win the standout title because, obviously, Lee Haney from 1984 to Ronnie Coleman in 2005 or 2004. Yeah, 22 years of Mr. Olympias that were all 5'10", 250 pounds plus. It wasn't in the cards, but, you know, I was able to economize that. I just wanted to be the best Sean Ray.
Yeah.
And in being the best Sean Ray, I would never have to really work a day in my life. And I don't think I ever worked a day in my life. I mean, training with weights has not worked for me. It was passion.
Yeah. How did it feel, Sean, winning the 85 Teen Nationals? Because you had to really feel that you had a really good shot at becoming a pro bodybuilder after winning a big title like that, huh?
Absolute validation. You know, my parents and some close friends still didn't realize that I was walking away from a football career, a promising one. My football jersey, number one, has never been worn since 1983, my senior year. They retired it.
Wow.
I'm in the Football Hall of Fame. I have the longest run from scrimmage, 98 yards. I still have the most yards, rushing yards, in my 3-year varsity career. I mean, I'm 30 years out of high school. I mean, that record should have been broken a long time ago. I mean,
yeah, wow.
My senior year, I was going through the motions because I couldn't wait to get to the team national championships. And when I lost in 1984, going back in 1985, I was committed to winning and committed to being a bodybuilder. It validated everything because real quick, I met Joe Weider in 1986, and I was on the cover of Flex magazine for the first time. I was barely 19 years old. Bodybuilding wasn't something you did for the money. And I think that's a big difference in the group of guys I came up with and the group of guys that are there today. The whole class before me, the whole generation, 10 years, 15 years before me, they did it because they wanted to be the best.
Yeah.
Some people made money as a byproduct of being really good. I found a way to monopolize, or I should say monetize, not monopolize, but I found a way to monetize my career to keep the wheels going so that I can continue going to those Mr. Olympias. But I was driven by being the best. And so winning that teenage national championship in 85 put me in very good company. I know that Lee Haney had won the teen national title, and then, you know, look where his career had gone. But I was more than ever driven to become the best junior in the world. So I just went to the next level. And at 20, I went to Australia and won the 1985 Junior World Championships. Albert Beckles was second in the Mr. Olympia that year. He was the guest poser. And so I got a very good up close and personal look at what an Olympian looked like. You know, 2 months after the Mr. Olympia, there was Albert Beckles, 46 years old, and I was 20. I realized I had a long career ahead of me to want to look like Albert Beckles. And the irony in that was it would only be 3 years later that I'd be standing on stage next to Albert Beckles.
Wow.
1988, my first pro show in New York that I was supposed to win the Night of Champions. I wound up in fourth. Albert Beckles was fifth. At the Mr. Olympia 1988, I was 13th and Albert Beckles was somewhere down the road. Now, granted, he was older, but it was only 3 years removed being the number two bodybuilder in the world. So I was on the right track, and I think that teenage national title really did kickstart my motivation to believe that I could do something with my body and in this business.
And you were living in California. You still do, Sean, but you grew up in California. So you were training, I'm sure, around some really good bodybuilders at that time when you were a teenager, right?
Absolutely. I think my first trip to the Mecca was in 1984, and I went down there with John Brown. He took me to World's Gym. And I'm sorry, it was 1983. I went to World's Gym, and it was just after the Mr. Universe, Mr. Olympia time, because there was we walked in and Bob Paris was still doing a photo shoot towards the back of the gym, and he had won the national championships in the Universe. Chris Dickerson was there in the gym. We were at World's Gym. Chris Dickerson was there, Danny Padilla, Tom Platz. I know I saw Matt Mendenhall and Rachel McLean. It was like I walked into the pages of Muscle and Fitness.
Yeah.
And all you could do was just look. I mean, I didn't want to even lift weights. I just wanted to see what the hell was going on.
Right.
And as I was doing that, I went to, back in those days, Eddie Giuliani, who managed the gym, the bench press and the incline, were the bars that held the straight bar were very close together. And I walked over to the bar, and I pulled off one side of the weights. That bar went like this. Bam! They don't play music in World Gym.
Right.
When that thing hit the ground, everyone looked at me. It was like sweat machine just went. I was more embarrassed. And Eddie Giuliani said, "What the hell are you doing? Get the hell out of my gym." And he's 5 feet tall.
Right.
But he came at me like pit bull. I was embarrassed. I got to tell you, I went after that. I waited for John downstairs, and we went over to Gold's Gym. And once I went into Gold's Gym, I had no reason to ever go back to World's Gym. And that was the World's Gym on Main Street. That was the gym, indoor-outdoor gym. And I was too embarrassed and too ashamed to go back to World's Gym until literally after I won the Mr. California 1987.
Wow, that's crazy. I never heard that story before. That's funny.
Yeah.
Let's go to 1986, because you did the Junior Nationals, which was in New York, Niagara Falls, New York. And you went up against Eddie Robinson.
Right.
And you and him were really, really close. I think you were, 20 years old at the time, right? And you ended up taking second place to Eddie.
Yeah, that was the show I was going to win. I was supposed to win on paper because I'd won the Teen Nationals. I'd won the Junior World Championships. And so people knew who I was. But it was from that show, I think it was prior to or just after. I think it was in May of 86 is when my cover shot came out later on after that. I was on the cover of Flex after that show.
Okay.
But I was a light heavy. I was a light heavy. And Eddie Robinson, I knew of him through the teenage, that he was a teenage powerlifting phenom.
Right.
He wasn't very cut. He wasn't very cut, but he was built like a man. I mean, he had the arms, the big sweeps on the quads, the big billowing calves.
Yeah.
Powerful chest because he had been so. He was definitely bigger. Was much thicker, much more muscular, and I was this more streamlined version. I don't even want to say I was ripped, but I think I looked like an athlete next to a powerlifter, and it was about muscle. And so I can concede defeat to Eddie Robinson, but the people with the trained eye after the show were telling me that I should have won.
Yeah.
And the right people were telling me that I should have won enough to believe that on any given day it could have gone either way. So I didn't feel like I lost.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like a loser. Depending on who you talk to, I could have won or he could have won. So that's fair enough. I mean, I wasn't used to losing, but I took it like a man, knowing that, you know, I'm going to see him again.
Yeah.
And I would see him again. It took a whole year, 1987, and I would come back this time as Mr. California, and I would meet him at the national championships in October, which basically was a game changer for the rest of my career and still affects the economy of my life today by winning the overalls at the 87 Nationals. And of course, you could believe I was paying attention to where Eddie Robinson was, and he wasn't in the top 10 of the heavyweight class.
Right. I remember that. Yeah. Well, I was in that show, Sean, the Junior Nationals. I competed. I was 23 years old. I just won the MPC Illinois, and I was like a light heavyweight. I was like about 201. And I remember I was going into the Junior Nationals, and my brother was telling me, why don't you just drop down and do light heavyweight? And I said, no, there's two guys that are going to be in the show that I don't want to go up against. One of them's Sean Ray, and one of them's Eddie Robinson. And my brother didn't know who they were. When he saw you guys, he's like, yeah, you were right. You shouldn't have gone up against those guys.
Yeah, my genetics allowed
me to stand. I mean, you were 20 years old, and you were so.
I didn't have the muscle.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't have the muscularity to compete with Eddie. You know what I mean? He had the powerlifting base, and I had the football background.
Yeah. But I remember seeing you at 20 years old. I was like, wow, this guy, this kid, you were so professional on stage and such a great poser. Did John Brown help you with your posing back then?
Yeah. John had planted many seeds in a lot of aspects of my life because he's 6'2", 250, black guy from Compton, didn't come from money. Was at Cal State Fullerton. I wound up going to Cal State Fullerton, but he was a mentor and more of a brother for me because I couldn't. My dad was a janitor. My other brother he played in a punk rock band. He surfed and he played football. And I was just trying to find my identity. And the closest thing to what I wanted to be was John. So naturally, I think all of us are a byproduct of people that we want to emulate. And so I watched and studied John when he didn't know that I was watching. I listened to him speak German on the phone, a second language, which was very impressive for a kid from Compton, you know, to be in the clothing business. And he was an art major at Cal State University in Fullerton. So the whole delivery, the business acumen, I picked up on that very young. I was 17 and I was studying what I wanted to be. So, you know, even going out, when we went out, I copied John. John got dressed when he went to a nightclub. He didn't just go to the gym in a tank top and a boat neck trying to show off his muscles.
Right.
It was all about class and style. It was all about presentation. It was all about, you know, perception. He was like Andre Agassi before Andre Agassi became popular with all those, you know, attitude commercials that he had back in the day. But where John and I differed was, you know, I lived at home with both my parents. And my mom was an accountant. My dad was a janitor. I cleaned toilets after I ran for 200 yards on a Friday night and dumped ashtrays and empty trash till 2 and 3 in the morning. And I would be there Saturday morning to watch game film and have to work out. John always thought there was another gear that I could take my bodybuilding to, another level, because I wasn't able to keep up with a grown man in training. I mean, John trained three body parts a day. He would do chest, shoulders, and arms on day one, back and legs on day two, chest, shoulders, arms on day three, back and, you know, I couldn't keep up. I was a growing kid. So I would quit often, but that laid a foundation for me that I would later take out on training partners as I grew into my body. And it really did. He made me quit enough times to where I was being embarrassed and I would have to come back to prove him that this is what I want.
Yeah.
You know, he would take me through these workouts and leave me on the floor. I mean, he would drive off from the gym and go and eat and come back and have to wait because I don't have a car and I'm stuck because we came together.
Right.
There was a lot of psychological things that tested my fortitude and my desire to want to be like him, because if I wanted to be like him, I was going to have to walk in his shoes. You know, I would have to do the drop sets. I would have to do the 100 reps. I would have to, you know, work within my capacity in terms of strength. But more importantly, I would have to do things that the other guys weren't doing. A guy besides Eddie Robinson that was out there was Victor Richards. And there was Doyle Washington. And he would throw these guys in my face, even though they were a little bit older than me. He would throw them in my face and say, I can never beat them because I don't have the mind. And so naturally, we keep hearing this over and over and over again. It wears on you to the point where you don't want to let the teacher down. And so these are my teenage years, 17 to 20, and I had John Brown in my corner. It shaped my adult life after that. I didn't need – when I won the national, I went to Atlantic City by myself. Victor Richards wound up bumming a room off of me because he was there with nowhere to stay, and he snored the whole night. But I went there by myself. I didn't have a training partner. I didn't have any friends. By then, that was where my career – went the Sean Redway, and I did everything on my own after that. But John was very instrumental in planting seeds. And I'm very aware of that when I meet bodybuilders today, that planting those seeds in those young guys' minds are very important. And I love to watch the fruits of my labor and influence with Richard Jones, working with Milo Sarchev, mentoring Flex Wheeler, guiding Kevin Lavroni, giving Phil Heath some advice. It's really cool to see what they would become.
Yeah.
And now I see why John took such a strong interest in me, because he saw the potential. But it also gave him a kick, because he was the puppet master behind the scenes that was like laying the foundation.
Yeah.
And then sitting out in the audience, he would see little glimpses of what his work was. And I'm sure he got a kick out of it, because I get a kick out of it today when I look at Melvin Anthony posing and some of the other guys, Vince Taylor.
Yeah.
John's fingerprints are on a lot of bodybuilders, very influential.
Where did John learn how to pose, Sean?
You know, he was a big follower of Serge Nubre.
Oh, okay.
Serge Nubre was a very strong influence and mentor. But there was nobody doing the things that John was doing when he was doing it. The whole breakdancing thing came around in the early 80s, and he was the only one with the attitude and the swagger that could pull it off. And since no one else was doing it, he just continued taking it to the next level. I mean, he would come out with a mask and a top hat. And he was very entertaining. I was more shy. I was more quiet. And I took more towards a Muhammad McAway, Chris Dickerson, Bob Paris, and the slow posing of John Brown. I was also very much an artist. And it was very hard for me to break that style to go into something that wasn't me. So I couldn't copy John verbatim.
Yeah.
But I took what John did, and I added it to a few of the other type of guys that I liked, and I put my name on it, you know?
Right. So in 87, that was your big year. You won the California, I believe, in the spring. And I remember, I wasn't at that show, but I saw your pictures in the magazines. And I remember after seeing you at the Junior Nationals the year before, I remember thinking how much thicker you were and how much more mature your muscularity was only in one year from 86 to 87.
And let me tell you, when you stand next to somebody like Eddie Robinson, you realize how much work you got to do. I mean, I wasn't lifting enough weight. I certainly wasn't eating enough food, and I knew then, because I competed in 1983, 84, 85, and 86. In May of 86, when we had that Junior Nationals, I was going to have a full year till May of 87 for the California for the first time. So I went to work. I mean, I really wanted that. I knew that by winning the Mr. California, I would be right there with my Christian, Roy Liedlmeyer, Bob Paris, and that would put me in the driver's seat going into the national championships. And mind you, I'm a bodybuilding historian, but I didn't do my history on the national title. I knew that Lee Haney had won it. I knew that Bob Paris in 83. I knew that in 84 was Mike Christian. 85 was Phil Williams. And 86 was Gary Strider.
Right.
But I didn't know anybody's age. I didn't know anyone's age. Age didn't matter. So when I went in and I actually won it, I was actually 22 and 1 month. I turned 22 1 month ahead. And the only younger person to win was Rich Gaspari, but he only won his class.
Right.
I won the youngest overall national champion. I'm still the youngest overall national champion to date.
Really? Wow.
But I never looked at that number as if it was some type of hindrance. Going in, I knew I was going up against Vince Taylor and these older guys, but I just did what I thought I had to do. Because even when I won the California, I got criticized by Mike Christian. I got criticized by John Brown. And when you win and these influential people are criticizing your work, you realize you have a lot of work to still do. And so what I did after the California, I started implementing fish into my program. I started doing cardio, like Mike Christian was saying. And then I started posing a lot after I trained. Mike Christian said, you have to squeeze the muscles. You can't just train the muscles. You have to flex and pose the muscles. John was good at laying the foundation on how hard I needed to train. But this is a time where I'm by myself. I don't have John in my corner in 1987. I'm alone in this.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure it all out. So when I won the Cal, John Brown wasn't even at the Cal. I don't even know where he was during this time. But I was bouncing from different gyms and biting off of different training partners. But I was really walking to the beat of my own drum with no structure, with no guidance, just knowing that I had to be bigger and stronger. And I took my weight training off season very serious. And then obviously I knew once I got the size, I needed to rip it up. So there was a dramatic change in my physique from May of 87 to October. And it was strictly because I started eating a lot of fish and I started doing a lot of cardio and I did a lot of posing. And that was Mike Christian's advice.
Okay. So going into that 87 Nationals, did you feel like this was your show? And, you know, we didn't know ahead of time before that Nationals how competitive that show was going to be. I think that stands to this day as one of the most competitive MPC Nationals ever.
I think I had a very good advantage, John, because I only knew one or two people. I knew Eddie Robinson was going.
Yeah.
And I knew that Vince Taylor was going, because Vince Taylor was friends with John Brown from Germany. They met in Germany.
Okay.
Outside of that, I think Troy Zuccolato was there too, and he was my training partner off and on. But I didn't give a shit. I didn't care who was going.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that I won the Mr. California and that Mike Christian and Bob Paris both won the California and they both became national champions. So it was expected of me training in Gold Gym that there was only one order of business, and that's to go and win.
Yeah.
I mean, when you have people telling you, mind you, I'd already been on the cover of Flex Magazine. I had already met Joe Weider several times. I was literally a permanent weekend fixture down at Gold's. I was going to pick up my title.
Yeah.
Between the prejudging and the finals, you got to remember that was a 2-day show.
Yeah.
So prejudging was Friday night, and Saturday when they did the women, I was over at the Stacy Kaufman's Pro Tan. He's the owner of Pro Tan. I was at his booth signing autographs for Mr. California. Because John Brown had told me, when you go there, you need to take your pictures because you've been on the cover of the magazine. People know you. They're gonna want a picture of you. And it didn't feel arrogant to me. It
yeah.
felt like I'm going there. I'm a celebrity. I'm supposed to make some money. I made some money so I could kind of hang out in Atlantic City and eat some food and upgrade my hotel room because I was selling pictures. I was doing what a professional bodybuilder does even before I became a pro. So I had no reservations when I landed in New Jersey that I was going to lose. The only time I was skeptical was when I stood next to Phil Hill.
Yeah.
I never stood next to a bodybuilder that big in my life, and I wasn't certain that I could beat somebody like that. Clearly, I could see that his thighs were a little bit overblown. His arms were overblown. He had narrow clavicles, but he had a big, thick, billowing chest. His calves weren't all that. But there was just so much more muscle than I'd ever seen. And mind you, I trained with Victor Richards at that time, and I'd seen Eddie Robinson. But I'd never stood next to someone like Phil Hill, and I didn't know what the judges were going to do. So I was not home free until literally that was over. I mean, I know I killed it on the posing routine, and what an honor it was to have Lyle Alzado introduce me with Mike Katz because I had talked to Lyle in Gold's Gym, and that's where he was training at. So to have him – and I'm a football buff, to have him say, ladies
yeah.
and gentlemen, Sean Ramos, like, I'm going to go out there and kick. I'm going to kill it right now. And then, you know, have Mike Katz there. I felt that was probably, in all of my career, John, that was probably the most perfect alignment of physical development, confidence, and preparation that I'd ever had. I just didn't feel I was going to lose on that night. I didn't know how I could lose. The only way I could lose was obviously to lose to a bigger guy like Phil Hill. But even then, I felt like I was more complete. So it was fitting that I brought my pictures because I sold a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about that posing routine too, Sean. What gave you
that
the
stands
idea?
Out more? That
what gave you the idea to do the posing routine from the song from Dreamgirls? Because I think when you did that routine, man, I remember I was watching that. I was blown away. I mean, I had seen guys like Muhammad McAway pose before, of course, Chris Dickerson, Bob Paris. But some of the stuff you were doing with moving your hands and, you know, lunging from side to side, I had never seen that before. And I thought that was a pretty bold move to pose like that.
Well, you got to realize, first time I posed that song, John, was in 1985.
Okay.
I had a local contest coming up that came before the Teen National Championship. So I jumped in. It was in April. The Teen Nationals were in June. I used it as a warm up. And I posed to that song. Mike Glass was the promoter at Anaheim Convention Center.
Mm-hmm.
Almost 4,000 people. The guest poser was also Albert Beckles and Beth Francis. And I posed to it then, and it was an abbreviated version of it because the teenagers, they got like a minute.
Yeah.
At the Nationals, if you watch that routine from start to finish, it's 3 minutes and 30 seconds.
Wow.
So they didn't turn my music off, and that was the last thing I told the guy on my way out. I said, make sure I'm posing to the whole song, so don't fake me out. And he didn't. So if you go back and watch it, I'm almost certain it's like 3:30 or 3:15, and nobody had posed to on that stage that long to dominate. But I wanted the extended version of that song because really the ending is what makes the whole routine.
Sure, yeah. That's a big dramatic ending.
And, you know, things like – the moments like that don't happen. And I say that in all my seminars around the world. You have to prepare. You got to be ready and you got to be confident. And so I knew the song was going to move me, but physically being prepared – it was like it was just I was posing for myself. It was like I was at home. I remember this was in the convention center. This was in the Atlantic. This is where Mike Tyson fights.
Wow.
I mean, that arena that they held the Nationals was massive. And Mike Tyson did. He fought 2 weeks later, and we ran into him on the boardwalk that weekend. But I was a little overwhelmed at prejudging because, you know, half the audience shows up. It's not packed. And we're in this big place, and the stage is huge. And I just felt like a little tiny thing on that stage when I was out there by myself for the mandatories. But by the time that song came on and I had some feedback from the prejudging the previous night, I felt I had a Michael Jackson moment.
Yeah,
and I say that because Michael Jackson was never off. You know, him and Elvis Presley. Elvis never had a bad night on the stage vocally, and Michael Jackson, if you saw him a million times, he was never off. And I think that was where the stars aligned for me. And that Dreamgirls song was something that no one else was doing, and I thought that would make me stand out. And the only other person that moved me was Phil Hill when he did the Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Now, I've never seen a big guy move like that to Phantom of the Opera,
right.
But I can tell you now that when you go back through the annals of bodybuilding and how important posing was, everyone that was good, they have a moment. And I think if they go looking for a Sean Ray moment, they're going to find that moment. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to stand out more than the rest.
Wow, that's awesome. So after the 87 Nationals, you were like the phenomenon of the bodybuilding world. 22 years old, you win the Nationals. It's one of the toughest Nationals ever. Not only that, Sean, but the way you looked was incredible because you were so perfectly developed, thick, ripped, with a great routine. What was the feedback after that, like probably a month or two later when the magazines started coming out and you were hailed as like one of the best Nationals champions ever?
It was slow, John. I thought I would come home and a week later everybody would be talking about me. It was slow. I went back to college. Monday I was right back in the classroom. I did a couple photo shoots out there in Atlantic City. I had several of them lined up here in Venice Beach, but it was business as usual. It wasn't like my phone was ringing off the hook. We're going towards the end of the year. We're going into the holidays. The Nationals at that time was like the last show of the year.
Yeah.
I didn't start getting any fanfare until around February, when the cover of the magazine came out and it was in the grocery stores. And then I started receiving the fan mail from the address that was in Flex magazine.
Yeah.
And I knew I needed to let them know how to find me. So what I did was I got Flex Magazine, and I think the editor-in-chief at the time was Bill Reynolds. He's passed away.
Yeah.
I asked him for the addresses. I said, is there any gyms or supplement stores that have addresses? So he gave me a bunch of addresses. And then through the NPC, I needed to know who the promoters were. So I got the NPC magazine, and if you'll note, in the back of the NPC book, it has the dates and the names and the addresses and all that information. And I went to the business. I printed up about 200 8x10s. I autographed them all personally to every contest promoter, every gym, every little vitamin shop.
Wow.
And I sent them all out. I figured if I'm sending out 200 or 250, if I get 10, that could come back to be 10 weeks worth of work.
Yeah.
That could be 10 guest posings. Needless to say, it certainly helped people find me, because here I was soliciting them, letting them know how to reach me if they need me for seminars, guest appearances, grand openings, whatever. And that was the beginning of my career, because now I realize I can take control of when and where I want to go and what fees I want to charge. And I had options, and some I had to say no to because they would come back at the same time. But because I sent them out in February, the bodybuilding season was like starting in March. Literally from May till the following October, I was booked solid, which definitely affected my pro debut at the Night of Champions in May. It killed my chances at the Olympia because I booked all these appearances for the guaranteed money, not realizing that, you know, when I won the Nationals, I wasn't traveling. Yeah. I wasn't guest posing. I was just eat, sleeping, and training and going to school.
Right.
But now I had to travel, stay in hotels, train on the fly, and do the business of bodybuilding that I was not really equipped to do.
Yeah.
And I made a lot of mistakes along the way. And so my first year was a learning experience, but I needed that to put my career in perspective, and then to realize there's a window, there's a time and a place to do business. But if I wanted to be one of the best, if I wanted to be able to compete, I needed to have those blocks of time to do that. And right before the Olympia is not the time to be traveling all over the world.
Right. So talk about that first pro show, Sean, that Night of the Champions in New York. Bob Paris, Robbie Robinson, Phil Hill, yourself. I think you were probably one of the favorites to win after your Nationals win. So how did that go? What were your feelings on that show?
Again, because I already barely started traveling. I mean, literally, the weekend after Night Champions, I was on the road again. That was a show I was supposed to win. You know, Robbie Robinson had won that show. It was a very prestigious. I was blown away that I was going to get to compete with Bob Paris. You know,
yeah.
I mean, Bob Paris was a guy from a distance that I wanted to be like as well. Bob Paris was a guy, when you saw him, he was always wearing the right clothes. He didn't look like a muscle meathead. His hair was done perfect. Every girl in America, around the world, wanted Bob Paris, every guy for that matter. but he was a gentleman, and he didn't – it's like looking at some of the football players. Like, now there's a mandatory dress code. You've got to wear a suit and tie.
Yeah,
you know, to the football stadium and come off the bus, whatever. Well, I mean, it spoke volumes to see somebody like Bob Paris, polished, meticulous in a magazine, and then in real life. I mean, he paid attention to his outward appearance, so he stood out.
Yeah,
you know, as someone walks into a room, and you go, "Holy crap,
yeah.
It's Bob Paris."
Yeah.
I wasn't even thinking about Phil Hill. I didn't even think about Phil Hill. He was in my rear view. It was Bob Paris that I had to beat, and of course, Robbie Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a disadvantage because I was young. But more importantly, I had moved out of my mom's house, got into my own apartment at the beginning of 1988. I got a $1,000 contract from Joe Weider. And I had a car. The car payment was $289, and I got an apartment, two-bedroom, for $700. So there went that $1,000. I still need gas, food, and all the other stuff. So I had to find a way to make it work. And while I was doing that, I was training for the Night of Champions. So I had to take all these guest appearances.
Yeah.
And I wound up in fourth place. I think the only real disappointed people out there were the ones that believed I was going to be the next Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
I thought and believed that I would be Mr. Olympia, but I thought it would also take time because of my age. And I thought I had time because of my age. So it was a marathon in my mind, not a sprint. Getting fourth place qualified me for the Mr. Olympia. It was going to be held in Los Angeles, so there was no way in hell I was going to miss it.
Right.
I guest posed all summer long. I think I guest posed up to 2 weeks before for the LA Mr. Olympia. And I got to tell you, both of those experiences for me were necessary to shape how I would return to the Mr. Olympia. So I don't understand how guys qualify for the Olympia and go, oh, I'm going to take a year off. I'm not big enough. I'm going to wait. I jumped at the opportunity to gain the experience. So even though I knew I wasn't going to be a winner in that show, there I was with the guys that were on my walls. I still had their pictures in my closet. I still had the visions and mythical ideology of how these people would look and sound in real life. And there I was backstage, you know, helping Gary Strydom, the 87 national champion, putting oil on his back. I was warming up with Barry DeMay. I was standing there next to Ron Love. I mean, the 1985 heavyweight champion. I mean, there were so many valuable experiences in losing that it prepared me for that 12-year run of being in the top five of the Mr. Olympia. And there's obvious reasons why I didn't win the Mr. Olympia. But every year after that, there could be a strong argument that I was in contention for the title. And that's all I could do.
Right, right.
That's all.
So tell me a little bit more about that 88 Olympia, Sean. I mean, after taking fourth at the Night of the Champions and going into it, did you know it was just going to be for experience? Were you at all intimidated because you're going up against guys like, you know, Lee Haney, Rich Gaspari, Barry DeMay, Gary Strydom?
Yeah. I think if you could have gotten in my head, John, you would have heard a little kid laughing. I couldn't believe I was at the Mr. Olympia. It's like, pinch me, I'm here.
Right.
It's like, where are all those haters that said I wasn't going to make it? Where? I mean, there was a lot of satisfaction in just getting there. Now, on the journey, Big Mama, my mom's mother, my birthday was September the 9th. That's the night we weighed in and we had the robes on.
Yeah,
and I
remember
weighed 202 pounds. That was my birthday, Friday night.
Oh, really?
So my whole family, everyone's coming. Well, that night, my grandmother died. My grandmother died at my mom's house. She was home. She was there. She was ill. So here I am training in all this, situation where the family's coming and going, and I'm going to check on my mom, and I'm going back to my apartment, and I'm training for the Mr. Olympia. It was triumph and tragedy at the same time because this my first real experience with death. My dad's stepfather died when I was 9 years old, but I didn't understand that funeral at all. Here's my mom's mom living in the house that I was living in and just moved out of. And they were going through that. And so after the 88 Olympia, I'm at a funeral. But while I was there, I mean, again, I'm by myself. I'm at Universal Studios and we're in the weigh-ins. Like, got on the robes and I'm looking at Lee Haney. I couldn't have been less confident and more excited than any other time of my career because I wasn't in contention. Had I been ready for that show, my demeanor would have been totally different. But I knew I had the best seat in the house. I felt like George Plimpton, like the paper lion. You know, yeah. It was one of those situations where I'm on the team with these guys, and I hope I don't stand out too much. But I'm on the team. I'm here.
Yeah.
So that was probably one of the more memorable Mr. Olympia moments for me. Rich Gaspari was at the top of his game. You know, Lee Labrada was right there in the mix. Even Mike Quinn was there. There's so many. That 1988 Mr. Olympia was probably more of an impact on me than the times I came first runner-up in 94 and 96 just because of the time and the place in the history of bodybuilding where even the losers were considered, like, mythical champions.
Yeah.
We all had our guys. I mean, Bob Paris hadn't won anything, but he was there. I mean, and that's when he did the Tracy Chapman routine.
Yeah.
I think Lee Labrada, that was probably one of his best routines ever. I mean, Barry DeMay, that was his pinnacle. He got third in that Olympia, and he never was as good as he ever was there.
Yeah.
Gary Strydom, that's where we found out that Gary Strydom was human because going into that Olympia, he took a picture next to Lee Haney in Gold Gym, and we thought, wow, this shoulder to shoulder. And Gary's got better delts.
Yeah.
What's going to happen when he diets down? And, of course, Gary was exposed. He over-dieted and everything disappeared, especially the back. But, man, I mean, that Olympia was – and I beat Samir Banu there.
Yeah.
So I kept going. I beat Samir Banu. I beat Albert Beckles. I beat Robbie Robinson. So even in defeat, man, I still felt like I was accomplished. I was in the middle of the pack, not the back of the pack.
Yeah.
And, of course, after that, I never placed out of the top five. So – I was in my glory in 1988 in defeat.
Yeah. So now going into 1989, you were off that whole year, right, Sean? But it wasn't because, like you were just saying about some of these other pros, where I got to take a time off, I got to grow a little bit more. You were actually injured. You hurt your neck or something, right?
I got injured training, yeah. Mike Christian and I were training. We were doing drop sets. We were doing legs at Gold's Gym. And you know how you hold your breath and you strain and you push, and I'm pushing, I'm using my hands. And it just felt like something had popped and went right up to the base of my head. Like,
yeah,
you know, I don't know what an aneurysm feels like, but it felt like something just goes boom, and then just like a big pulsating in the back of my neck. And of course, the next day, I literally, that was it for me. So the next day, it's totally stiff, and I can't do any of this, can't do any of this, I can't do anything. So I go to the doctor. They start doing some electric stimulation. Even the massage, it was too fresh to even massage and rub out.
Yeah.
But there was no nerve damage. There wasn't anything torn. I strained a muscle in my neck. Well, back then, you have to let the IFBB vice president know, and that was Wayne D'Amelio.
Right.
I let Wayne D'Amelio know at that point, literally when it happens, so Wayne, I'm not going to make it in this show, man. I'm not going to be able – I can't train. And the doctor told me don't do anything for at least 10 days. Now, I'm 5 weeks out from the first ever Arnold Classic.
Right.
And I had talked to Arnold – I went to Arnold's office and talked to him about competing. He called my mom and talked to her on the phone. And it was a very big opportunity. Mind you, I'm 5 weeks out, so I've already got 6-7 weeks in the bank.
Yeah.
Training for this show. And I'm pulling out. And Mike Christian's basically saying, see how you feel next week. I'm laying around the house and not doing a whole lot. I'm eating, and I'm not trying to do sit-ups. I can't pull my head up to do a sit-up. I can't do anything. I can't hold my breath and strain and continue doing legs. So I'm already defeated. I'm like, forget it. I'm out. And I told Wayne D'Amelio then. So he said, make sure he gets the medical documentation. So I have the doctor fax Wayne D'Amelio all the information from the fourth and third week of the muscle stimulation and the massage therapy. And that was it. We didn't talk again. I land in Columbus, Ohio on the plane ticket that Jim Lorimer got me. Check into the hotel in the hotel that Arnold and Jim got me. Show up at the athletes meeting to address what's going on. And Wayne D'Amelio basically says, are you competing? I said, no. He says, well, then you're suspended. What do you mean I'm suspended? You don't have any proof? I said, what do you mean I don't have? I didn't bring any medical documentation. I faxed it to you. Like, I don't have any fax. I said, wait, are you shitting me? I mean, I told you on the phone. I mean, Joe Weider knows I'm not competing in the show.
Right.
Well, one thing led to another. I got suspended for a year, and I was actually relieved. You know what? Because I wasn't ready to get on that stage. I had already resigned myself to eating hamburgers and pizza and realizing that that show was out of my economy. Now it's out of my control.
Yeah.
So all I can do at this point, John, all I can do – and by the time I got to Columbus, Ohio, I'm okay. I'm actually able to work out a little bit. I'm able to maneuver, and I'm actually getting back in the gym. I just went to the work. I started making myself available for appearances. I guest posed all of 1989. I probably traveled more in 1989 than I ever did.
Hmm.
I wound up in Japan with Barry DeMay, who had torn his pec after the 88 Olympia. I went to Russia for the first time to guest pose for the representing the USA versus Russia team. I was in all up and down Italy and all over England. Wayne D'Amelio did me a favor. At a very pivotal point of my career, a weaker person might have turned that into a very bitter situation. Yeah. I turned it into profit, and I turned it into an opportunity, because I wasn't going to let Wayne D'Amelio stop me from becoming who I had set out to be. I had too much invested. So I went out and made as much money as I could, and I said, 1990, I'll be back. 1990, I'm going to be back and shock the world like Muhammad Ali said.
Right. Now, did you go to were you at the 89 Olympia show? Were you watching it?
Yeah, it was on my birthday. Barry DeMay and I were out in he was the one buying me drinks.
Yeah, I remember reading you and Barry DeMay were out there, yeah.
Yeah, we went from Russia, where I did guest posed, and I, Penny Price and I guest posed, and then I met up with Barry in Italy, and it fell on September the 9th. So you can imagine, here I am, sitting in the audience of a show that I thought I was going to one day, you know, that I should have probably been in.
Right.
I was fat and happy, but I had dieted. I was guest posing. But I really stared at and I studied from the audience. Mind you, my first Olympia experience, I was on the stage in 1988. My second Olympia experience, I was in the fifth row. Sitting there with Barry DeMay, And both of us kind of going, we'll never be able to look like that. We're drunk. We had a couple of drinks.
Right.
We're like, we are so far away from looking like that. I mean, look at Labrada. Are you kidding me? I can't stand next to that. I mean, he was the yardstick for me.
Right.
Look at this Taylor. I'm a million miles away from looking. Do I look like that, Barry? Do you think neither one of us, Barry's like convinced his career's over.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I'm in the audience and I'll never be able to qualify for the Mr. Olympia. It's not real. It looks totally different when you're sitting there looking at it with the lights and the oil. When you're on stage next to it, you can't conceptualize how well developed everybody else is.
Right.
So with that being said, on my birthday, I vowed then, when I got back from Italy, that I'd be coming back in 1990 and I would prove Wayne D'Amelio wrong. I'd get my title and, it would be a game-changing year for me in 1990 because I had that whole 1989 to make the changes I needed to.
Yeah. All right, so now we go into the 1990 Arnold Classic, and you're coming back. This is your comeback. And you go into that. Now, they did something different. This is your the first time they do drug testing, and they were going to drug test all the pro shows that year, the big pro shows like the Arnold and the Olympia and the – I don't think they did the Night of the Champions.
No.
But you go into the Arnold Classic, and – no, I'm sorry. Before that, you did the Ironman, the first pro Ironman. Yeah. Yeah, and I was there. I was in California. I saw you win that show, and you posed to Luther Vandross, and you beat out Mike Ashley, and you were amazing at that show. Way better than you'd ever been. That was your up to that point, your best ever, right?
Yeah, it was a matter of conditioning. I knew that I needed to be in condition. Look, I was 202 pounds in L.A., and I was soft. I was literally the same amount of weight here when a full year later, actually it was almost two, right? Because I was 88. I went all the way through 89. So
right.
I knew I would need to be refined. But we got the notification that they were drug testing the Arnold Classic in, I believe it was November.
Hmm.
So when we got that notification, I was all in. Nothing more sweeter than the news that the drug test is going to come because it's going to change the game for all the big guys and it's going to favor me. So clearly, not knowing how the whole process works, I've never been drug tested in my life, and I don't know how long drugs stay in your system, and I don't know what type of testing they're going to use. So no one has an inside track. All you can do is get off of whatever you're taking. So I came clean off of everything I was taking. November. Went into the Ironman. I beat Mike Ashley, Vince Comerford, and, of course, Gary Stratton. And I was very confident that I was going to win that show. I thought Gary Stratton had been exposed at the 88 Olympia. He became one of those guys that I thought had a great gym physique.
Right.
But there was a lot of flaws. So he didn't scare me. Vince Comerford, I thought he was a little too puffy. Even when Vince won the Nationals, I thought he was big arms, big legs like Eddie Robinson, but couldn't get the thin skin.
Yeah.
Mike Ashley, I thought was good at certain poses, but he wasn't structurally put together very well. His thighs didn't look right. His calves were kind of funky.
Yeah.
Had some really good biceps, some really thick abs, but there was no real pretty aesthetics to it. So I was confident going into that show, and I won. 2 weeks later, all I did was stay on my diet. 2 weeks later, I go to Columbus, Ohio, and I win again. Have dinner with Arnold and Maria and my dad, and then I took off to Canada. Came back home, and I went to Canada for a week's worth of appearances. And while I'm in Canada, Wayne D'Amelio called me and said, your test result came back positive. Do you want to test sample B? You can do that at UCLA in California or go to Chicago. I said, well, I imagine if sample A is positive, I mean, sample B is probably going to be the same piss, Wayne. I mean, what do you mean it's positive? He said, well, I mean, obviously we're going through and you're not the only one that failed. I'm not at liberty to tell you who else failed, but I can tell you you failed the test. We saw the results. I said, so what do I do? I'm not sure what you do, but you won't be getting your $60,000. And you will have to return the trophy. I mean, Wayne is very matter of fact.
Yeah.
I mean, I would hate to have him deliver the news that I lost a son in the war because there would be no emotions that delivered at all. But I hung up the phone with him in Canada. I called Joe Weider. I said, Joe, did you hear what happened? He says, yeah, Sean, I'm messing here. You're qualified for the Mr. Olympia. You got to go and you got to pass the test. I said, well, I can still do the Mr. Olympia? He said, well, you're qualified. Yes, you're going to do the Olympia. I said, well, that's all I need to know. I didn't have time, John, to think about money that I didn't have. I never had the check. I never saw $60,000.
Right.
I was looking at buying a house with that as a down payment combined with the pro Ironman check, that would have been $70,000 total. That would have been a nice down deposit. A lesser guy would have crumbled. And again, I never got into bodybuilding for the money. I'm trying to be Mr. Olympia. And I'm qualified for Mr. Olympia. So screw it. I'm going to continue doing my tour. And I'm going to go back in the gym. And I'm going to win the Mr. Olympia. I didn't think in my wildest dreams that I would fail a test. And when I did, it's not like they had social media. I mean, it trickled out like months later.
Right.
You know, I had to go to find out what happened. And then by the time it got across the pond over in England and all the other countries, we were in the month of May. Well, in May, I was already training for the Olympia. This was old news to me.
Right.
My life didn't change. What changed was me having to give the trophy back because I had to take it off my mom's fireplace. I gave that to her. But because it wasn't about the money and I didn't really have the money spent and I was making a lot of money and had a lot of plans after that 1990 Arnold Classic, I was so busy. I didn't have time to like let it sink in. I had to go to the next state, next country. And I was guest posing all the way up till like June.
Okay.
And by the time June came, I was ready. You know, I was in high gear for the Mr. Olympia. The only thing that happened is I got a little bit smaller. I went into the Mr. Olympia 1990, and they did things differently. They got the drug test back before the finals. And in doing so, we knew going into the finals that Mohamed Benaziza, Barry DeMay, Vince Comerford, and a couple other guys weren't going to be able to make that contest because they tested positive.
Right.
None of them impacted me. I knew Mohamed Benaziza would be tough. He beat Dorian Yates that year at the New York Night of Champions.
Right.
So Mohamed Benaziza in May was supposed to be a very tough competitor, but he took himself out of the game. So I focused on trying to win the show. And when prejudging was over, a lot of people thought, and myself included, that this title was very slippery in Lee Haney's hands. Lee Haney was not the dominating force that he had been in years past.
Right.
And that the contest potentially was going to be between me and Labrada because we stacked up a little more favorably. What happened to my body by that time is my back got a little bit more narrow. And the crispness that I had at the Ironman earlier in the year wasn't really there. Me and Lee were both slightly flat, but he was vascular, had a very nice tan. And you got to remember, Lee Labrada was second place in 1989 at Mr.
Right.
Olympia.
Right.
So if there was any edge, it was going to go to Labrada. And, of course, it automatically to Lee Haney. So I was able to get my arms around the fact that if I get third in the Olympia, it's success. Because I was 13th place in my last Olympia.
Right.
Was I content with getting third? Was I happy with getting third? No. After the show was over, I started getting pissed off because every person that I ran into thought I should have beat Labrada. Hmm. And then other people that I talked to thought that Labrada should have beat Haney. So it was like it was like yin and the yang. Like, wait, I should have beat Labrada, but Labrada should have beat Haney. I mean, it was all too confusing.
Right.
To get caught up with the subjectivity of the outcome of a show.
Yeah.
All I knew is I was in the top three of the world, and I arrived. I can go home, my head up. I passed the drug test. I'm top three. And my parents couldn't have been more proud of their son in that moment. And my friends couldn't have been more happy for me in that moment that I passed the test and was third in the world. And all the bodybuilders that I leapfrogged over, you know, but I had unfinished business. I wasn't content with getting third. I had to go back to Columbus.
Yeah.
I had to go back and get this. I had to go back for this one. So I totally turned everything that I had, everything that I was, on winning that 91 Arnold Classic title. I mean, I never was more devoted to anything in life besides getting that title back in 1991, and I don't care who was going to be there. So this is the third year they had the Arnold Classic,
right.
And it was my second stay in the spotlight on the victory stage, and it would be many, many, many years later, 2010 to be exact, that I would have that conversation with Mike Ashley about stealing the spotlight. And, you know, things happen for a reason, John. They had to screw that whole testing result up for them to get it right for the Mr. Olympia.
Right.
But Mike Ashley was the perfect gentleman in that, you know, I may have lost $60,000 by failing a drug test, but I didn't lose the moment of victory on that stage with Arnold and having the title and being perceived the champion. I'm a firm believer. If there's rules, stick to the rules. Don't bend them. Don't break them.
Yeah.
I failed the test. It's all yours, Mike. But Mike said that, you know, just the idea that I failed the test and he passed validated everything that he'd been preaching. He said he was a lifelong natural bodybuilder.
Mm-hmm.
Who am I to argue with that? I know that on that day he passed the test and he was the rightful champion, and no one ever really made amends for him to have that moment, you know, fixed for him. He never knew what it was like to get his picture with Arnold. He never got validated. So when I did the Evolution of Bodybuilding, Arnold Sports Festival 25 documentary,
yeah,
I had a good chance to talk with Mike Ashley, and I mean he's a stud. The way he handled the conversation, because I really felt like in that moment, like the Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, or the Ali Frazier rivalry,
yeah,
that Mike and I kind of had that yin yang, but we never went at each other. The fans went at each other. My fans were saying that he's full of crap, he's not natural, and
mm-hmm.
and you know, he got the trophy behind closed doors type thing, and they really wanted to dismiss Mike Ashley, but he was the winner in 90, and I boned up to that.
Yeah. Sean, what were the feelings of all the competitors about that drug testing, and especially at the 90 Olympia, because you had all the guys being tested, Lee Haney and Lee Labrada and Rich Gaspari, and I mean, what was everybody's feelings about the way the IFBB was going about doing the drug testing?
Yeah, they all thought it was bullshit.
Yeah.
There wasn't a guy on that stage that was no one really wanted it. I think Labrada and I both wanted that drug test because it would change the game and in our lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
the way we prepare for competition to our advantage. Lee Haney was a shell of a person on that stage. Mike Christian, on the other hand, looked like he grew.
Yeah.
And so now you have to contend with who's smarter, like who's in your corner giving you advice. And,
yeah.
You know, who's taking the blocking agents and who's trying to beat the drug test. It just made it more complicated.
Right.
But, of course, I was the second smallest guy on stage in 1990 at the Arnold Classic and failed the drug test. Many guys were much bigger than I was. I mean, it's very hard to finger point. At the end of the day, it's a man's business. We survived not having the drug test in the pro ranks. I think there's more concern about diuretics, which kill people.
Yep.
But, you know, it's like cigarettes and alcohol. You make adult decisions, you deal with the adult consequences. But on this occasion, you know, if they say there's a drug test and it comes back positive, you're screwed. One little known fact that got swept under the rug is when it happened to Jay Cutler, my very last Olympia, 2001.
Right.
Jay Cutler failed the diuretic test and threatened a lawsuit, and suddenly the drug testing procedure was thrown out and null and void because the IOC did not have their registration for that calendar year for the IFBB. Very strange circumstances. I wasn't one of those guys that was going to threaten a lawsuit. I was 24 years young, and I knew I had a long career ahead of me. But along the way, the rules started to get bent,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't like what was happening. Kevin Lavrone didn't sign a contract to compete in the Mr. Olympia. Didn't even have a pro card registration for the Mr. Olympia 2001, and they let him in at the last minute, which didn't sit well with me. And Kevin and I were cool. We're friends.
Yeah.
But there's rules. So I was held to a higher standard when those rules came out. And as the rules started to get bent and shaped to fit certain people's needs, my passion was gone and contributed to my retirement.
Hmm. Okay. So then we go to the 91 Arnold, and now you get redemption and you take first place there.
It was like a dress rehearsal. I had been there and done that. There was absolutely nobody that was going to take. I felt like I was back at the Nationals in 1987.
Yeah.
Rennell Janvier got second, and we've never been compared since. People don't talk. I mean, Rennell Janvier was known for his ripped, shredded glutes.
Right.
But there was nothing ever more memorable about him. But
right.
There were some memorable guys in that show. There were other bodybuilders that came along that were in that show, but I won that with perfect scores.
Mm-hmm.
And when you win perfect scores, there's really nothing to talk about.
Yeah. Seemed like it was more competitive.
I was on my A game. And sorry?
I said it seemed like it was more competitive the year before in 1990.
Yeah, it was. And there was extenuating circumstances with the drug test. But, you know, that 1991 Olympia changed my lifestyle because Arnold winning that $70,000 afforded me to buy my first house. And so there's these little milestones in this sport that gives back to you. I mean, it takes everything you have. It takes everything from you. But in this instance, it gave me a sense of accomplishment. I bought a house, and in my dad's eyes, I became a man. It's a big thing. Buying a house and getting married are probably two of the, and having a baby are probably the big three, aren't they?
Yeah. So
for me, I came of age by buying my own house, and did it from the sweat of my brow. You know, I didn't work for anybody. I built my body, and they rewarded my body, and that was able to put a roof over my head. And I think that's when my mom and my dad and everybody became believers that I made the right decision to leave football.
Yeah.
It wasn't millions of dollars, but you know, I didn't need millions of dollars to do what I do. Like, you know, I needed to just keep the lights on and keep a roof over my head. I'm very thankful to Arnold and for creating that show. And I've never missed an Arnold Classic since. I just came back from the one in Australia, 27 straight years.
Wow.
I've been working at or participating in the capacity of the Arnold Classic. Now I go as an MC. I MC the amateur Arnold Classic, in Australia and here. I emceed the Brazilian Arnold Classic. And I've always gone back in terms of working with a sponsoring company or working for Muscular Development Magazine covering the show. So I've been a part of that growth where there was only 3,000 fans in year one in 89 when Rich Gaspari won it for $55,000, all the way up till, you know, our present champion, Dexter Jackson.
Yeah. So then let's go to the Olympia that year, Sean. There you go. That was Lee Haney's last year. And you go in, and you had to be one of the favorites, obviously, after taking the Arnold Classic that year and also being a top
model
the last couple of years. And you end up taking fifth place behind Labrada and Dorian Yates and Sean Ray. Dorian Yates, Vince Taylor, and Lee Haney, of course.
Well, and that was another year that was full of appearances. I peaked in March. And I was hanging on by a thread in September. That contest also was one day. Actually, I think that was September the 11th in Orlando.
Yeah.
And I'm a victim of water retention there. I was a victim of too much work, and I took it seriously. I saw Dorian Yates coming, and I wanted to be competitive. And sheer genetics kept me in the top five because Sonny Schmidt was very good that year.
Yeah, that's true.
He was sixth place. I still thought I had Labrada. I mean, I still didn't see what the judges were seeing in Labrada because he was just not carrying the size. I thought I closed the gap on him and I would surpass him that year. But, you know, having the Arnold Classic trophy with me that year, taking fifth place wasn't too bad.
Yeah. What did you think about Lee Haney winning his last title? He was pretty awesome that year, huh?
I was just glad to be there to see it, man. That's one of those moments where you know where you were in 1991 when Lee Haney's career came to an end, and I was standing right next to him. And Dorian Yates might have been as tall, might have been as wide, but he never stood a chance in beating Lee Haney that day.
Yeah. What did you think of Dorian? That was your first time competing against him.
Yeah, I had seen Dorian in guest pose with him in 1989 or 1990, and I thought, holy crap, you know, now I got to do – Haney's got eight. Now I got to deal with this guy.
Yeah.
So I saw the writing on the wall. I knew that 1992 Olympia would be wide open, and it's going to be a very subjective matter of opinions. And if I'm going to beat a guy like Dorian, I got to come in shredding. And so, of course, we got to 1992, and I think I might have came in just a little bit too light. I think the judges over-rewarded a return first runner-up in Dorian Yates. They over-rewarded him, I thought. I thought Kevin Lavroni had missed his peak because in 1992 – when he won the New York Pro Championships, he looked considerably better than when he got to Helsinki, Finland. And I don't think the world had ever saw me in the kind of condition I was in when I was in Helsinki.
Yeah.
I mean, that was – in Helsinki, I don't think I've ever been more ripped on a bodybuilding stage in my life.
Yeah, I was shocked to see you get fourth place at that show because even though Labrada looked good, Lavroni looked good, and Dorian looked good, I mean, why were you in fourth? Because you were so ripped and – you know, you were really in peak condition.
Yeah, I think I'm very fortunate, John, in a sense that I always use the Mr. Olympia as a vehicle to continue to create. From that weekend, I came home and I started with the Flex Magazine workout that had a 5-year run on ESPN.
Oh, yeah.
So I let the fans be upset and be mad. I mean, whenever you heard me talking and complaining, I was complaining about the winner. So my beef was always with the champion. But not winning that contest didn't destroy my faith that I would still have another opportunity at a future date to try to compete for that title. And, you know, when the contest was over, man, I don't even talk about it. I was moving on to the next order of business.
Where would you have placed yourself in that show, Sean? Where would you have put the placings in the 92?
Well, I thought in 1992 there could have been a case for an argument. I thought Kevin was off. I mean, his midsection was washed out. Yeah. I thought his thighs were a little bit down. His color was horrible. You know, you can see he had a very long torso in that show, and his lower back didn't have any detail. He was still a thinner, slender version of what he was in May when he won in New York. But he might have looked better in New York because he only beat Porter Cottrell.
Yeah.
I definitely thought I was going to be at least second place, fighting for first. Labrada was never a factor in that contest with me. As great as Lee was, I just thought he just didn't have the crisp detail that I had. I mean, I wish you saw pose for pose, still frames, to justify Labrada beating me in Helsinki, Finland. I could see them arguing that Kevin was bigger and Dorian was bigger, and therefore Sean's in third. But I just didn't understand how Labrada was beating me.
Yeah, what did you think of Dorian winning that year compared to how he looked the year before?
Clearly, the year before, Dorian was better. I think everyone suffered from that contest just being held in Helsinki. I mean, I know Dorian only had to have come from England, but I think he over-dieted. He didn't look the same. He wasn't as imposing. He didn't have Lee Haney to stand next to by comparison. So I wasn't over-impressed with Dorian, but I knew he was probably going to win just by default. I mean, that didn't take a rocket scientist to know that he was second and he was probably going to win.
Yeah. Let me ask you about Vince Taylor, because the year before in 91, Vince had his posing music and he targeted you and Lee Labrada specifically. Remember when he did his Terminator routine? How did you feel about that?
Well, I had made a comment that if Vince Taylor beats me, I'm going to retire. And I think that motivated me. Yeah, because he was John Brown's friend. He's 10 years older than I am.
Yeah.
He's a very good bodybuilder, but I just thought his skin was always kind of thick. His glutes were always watery. The hamstrings were never detailed. He was really all about biceps. His back didn't have a lot of. I could pick Vince apart, and I picked on him mentally more than anything else. But he's a perfect gentleman, and he's a showman. He's from the John Brown School, and I think that was kind of cool and interesting that he would actually put our names in his routine. He caught me sleeping in '91, but he never got me again.
Right.
For what time?
Yeah, the next year he was down in sixth, and you were in fourth.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, he was a non-factor in Helsinki. He had the patch on his eye and one of them. But it was very convenient timing, I think. Listen, if a patch had hit me in the eye, I still would have had the same condition.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
So, very convenient excuse.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. And I will see you guys next week after the Mr. Olympia is over with. And also next week, we will have part two of our interview with Sean Ray. So be sure to tune into that. Have a great week, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. Take care.